Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountRecovery.net, and I'm really excited to bring you today's webinar on a very important topic, FMLA and sick leave changes and government small business loan programs, what you need to know, which is being brought to you by ACA of Texas. One of the first acts taken by Congress to confront the coronavirus pandemic was to extend paid sick leave and family leave for individuals who have had their lives altered because of coronavirus. Additionally, in the third stimulus bill, there's been additional incremental funding for small businesses, which needs to be understood. Finally, the COVID-19 virus has made fundamental changes in the collection industry that need to be managed. In this webinar, Tom Good from Barron & Neuberger is here to walk through the changes that companies in the credit collection industry need to know about and how to adjust their operations in response. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountRecovery.net. AccountRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, offers a number of exciting podcasts, and manages a newly launched Slack channel for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speaker. Tom Good is a managing attorney at the law firm of Barron & Neuberger. Prior to joining the firm in 2014, Tom spent a decade as general counsel at two of the largest participants in the industry, Square 2 Financial and Asset Acceptance Capital. For both companies, he directed all legal affairs, negotiated both debt and equity financing, and made legal decisions for the client relating to compliance and regulatory matters. The format for today's webinar will be a presentation from Tom. We're going to try and keep questions to a minimum during today's webinar. To make sure nobody gets in any trouble, let me read the following disclaimer. This presentation is not intended to be legal advice. It may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area. It should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available either later today or by tomorrow on AccountRecovery.net's webinar recordings page. With that, I am going to hand it over to Tom Good to begin his presentation. Tom, it's all yours.
Thank you, Mike. I wanted to make a couple of introductory comments. First of all, I assume everybody is on AccountsRecovery.net. If you are not, you are missing probably the best industry daily update that is available. There are only two things I read every day, AccountsRecovery.net and MLB.com. And candidly, MLB.com has gotten a lot less interesting. So thank you for Mike for putting this on. Also, I want to thank ACA of Texas. The way this industry is going to get through is through its industry organizations and its members, and we really appreciate ACA of Texas taking a lead on this. So those are my commercials for the valued partners who have put this on. I also want to kind of bootstrap a little bit on what Mike said about questions. We may or may not have time at the end for Q&A, and really I think the best way to approach this presentation is to take the information provided and share it with your advisors, the lawyers, the accountants, the bankers that you individually interact with. If there isn't time for Q&A, I'll make myself available by email and by phone, you know, for anything that you want to chat about. And candidly, that may be a little better because I can at least then get some individual context for the questions. It seems like the coronavirus response has been going on forever, but if you look at the dates on the laws, and there are three of them, the first one became law on March 6th, which is just 25 days ago. So while it seems like the response has been slow and dragging from time to time, it actually, there have been three very detailed laws passed in a very short period of time addressing this. First was the Coronavirus Preparedness and Response Supplemental Appropriations Act, and that does seem like 1,000 years ago we passed it. It was designed to focus on the initial support for masks and ventilators and vaccine development. The second act is the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, and that has to do more with employee impact of coronavirus. It is the paid leave provisions, the unemployment provisions, food assistance, and that was $100 billion injection into the system, and that became law on March 18th, although the provisions weren't effective for 15 days from the date of the law being signed. The third act is the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, and that is really the major stimulus package. And the aspects of that that received the most attention, I believe, in the media were really the checks going out to individuals and also the loans to impacted industries. And not only the impacted industries, but the controls placed on the recipients of those loans. But the portion that I want to talk about from the CARES Act today is really the small business lending provisions. So just to give you an idea of where we're headed, I'm going to talk about the employment law aspects from the second act, or the second stimulus act, and then I'm going to talk about small business lending provisions, which were contained in the third act. And while they're very dissimilar, they're both very they are very impactful on small business participants, which I am assuming most of the people in this call fall into that category. There are essentially three different labor laws that were impacted in the second stimulus act. The there's an Emergency Paid Family and Medical Leave Act, an Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act, and then there are some modifications to the Internal Revenue Code. All of these are effective as of April 1, 2020. And what I want to walk through kind of the high-level important points of these, but I want to challenge people as they are starting to figure out how they're going to implement their responses, that it's essential to be smart in terms of how you're dealing with employees, to err on the side of being compassionate with your employees, and also to think about your image in the community as part of your response to the decisions that you have to make. The reason I mention this, and Mike, if you could move forward one slide, that'd be great. Or now back one. Just 30 minutes ago, one of my partners, Manny Neuberger, received a call from a industry regulator, and the regulator commented that he had received multiple tearful calls from collectors who were being told, and this is in a state that has a stay-at-home order, come to the office or stay home and don't get paid. And a couple observations about that. First of all, given these new laws, that may or may not be accurate. But secondly, I would challenge people that are delivering that message. How is that going to play if it hits the front page of your local newspaper? And also, will that build the long-lasting employee relationships that you want if you intend on continuing past this crisis? So just be sensitive is kind of the first overarching comment. But with that as background, I want to give a little bit of a refresher on the Family Medical Leave Act. You may recall this act came into play in 1993, and it provides for 12 weeks of 12 weeks of unpaid leave due to various specified provisions or clauses. For instance, you know, childbirth, adoption, caring for close relatives. It applies generally to companies with 50 or more employees. And once the leave is done, there is a right, subject to certain exceptions for high, highly compensated employees and for individuals who cause an emergency through their leaving with the business to be reemployed. And that's the basics of FMLA. And for companies that are under 50 of employees, generally the law doesn't apply to them. And so the knowledge base may not be that strong. Now, when I say generally, I mean that there are certain states that drop the level of 50 down to 15 or 25 for their particular state. The second coronavirus stimulus bill passed something that they deemed to be Family and Medical Leave Expansion Act. And really, a lot of the things that you already know about FMLA don't apply to this. First of all, unlike FMLA, the normal FMLA, this is this bill provides for paid medical leave. And that is something that is a significant difference. Secondly, the number of employees isn't 50 or less, or 50 or more. It is 500 or fewer, and that kind of is an odd dynamic of this. That this law was placed on smaller businesses, and the thought process, at least as I've read, is that there was a belief that people or employers with more than 500 employees may have more developed programs. And so what they were trying to do is they were trying to find a way to get certain tailored benefits to the employees of smaller businesses. And it's important, while there are three separate aspects to the employment laws, you've got to read them all together. Because the intention is to give benefits to employees and compensate the employers who provide those benefits. So read all three of these as one cohesive unit, and you'll understand it a great deal more. Now, the Family Medical Leave Expansion Act really only applies in one circumstance, and that is if your employees have child care issues due to schools being closed or daycare being closed, then they have the right to take this Family Medical Leave Expansion Act. And like I said, and like it says on the screen, it's 12 weeks of job protected leave. The first 10 days technically are unpaid, but when you see how it ties in with the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act, it really isn't an unpaid leave. After the 10-day period, employers must pay full-time employees, and let's keep that in mind, full-time employees, at two-thirds of the employee's regular rate. And there is an obligation to reemploy someone who takes emergency family and medical leave benefits as long as there are more than 25 employees in the company. Now, for people that are that have fewer than 25 employees, they're excluded from this if the job is eliminated due to economic downturn. And I think that, you know, there are going to be further regulations dealing with the likelihood of or the treatment of how you define what economic downturn is. But I don't think that anybody will have that difficult a time proving that they need to eliminate a job due to economic downturn. So, in summary, while the title is Family Medical Leave or Emergency Family Medical Leave Expansion Act, it has very little to do with what you think of as FMLA, because the benefits are paid, the benefits are limited to one particular circumstance, and it's applicable to employers who are 500 or fewer. The second act that really addresses the employment aspects is the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. This once again applies to employees with fewer than 500 employees. And what it is designed to do is it's designed to require employers to pay 2 weeks of paid sick leave for six specified reasons. The six reasons are the employee is subject to a federal, state, or local quarantine or isolation order related to coronavirus. If the employee is advised to self-quarantine due to COVID-19 concerns, that employee is subject to this right. If the person evidences COVID symptoms, first of all, you don't want them in the office, but secondly, this is a way of getting them paid leave that they might not otherwise have. Then and that's the first category or the first tranche of categories that that deal with paid sick leave, and that is something that is actually focused on the employee itself, or him or herself. The second category are employee impacts that are caused by third parties or the result of third parties. And that would be if the employee is subject to a federal, state, or local quarantine order, if they're caring for an individual who's subject to that order. So, you know, you've got a parent that is covered by an order and the person needs to go and assist. Well, that would be that would fall into this category. If you need to care for the employee's child, if the school or child care is closed, in other words, if it's the same sort of category as the Federal Medical Leave Act, there is a this also triggers the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act requirement, and we'll see how they tie together. And finally, there's a catch-all if the Secretary of Health and Human Services, in consultation with the Department of Treasury and the Department of Labor, determines that there's another category that they haven't thought of, they will add this to the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. And the reason why there's a difference between those two specific categories is that there's a different cap on the paid sick leave. If the triggering event for the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act relates to the individual as opposed to taking care of a third party, there's a cap of $511 a day or a total of $5,110 per employee for their use. If the sick leave is based on the need to take care of a third party, that cap drops to $200 a day for a total of $2,000. So what they're doing is they're providing 10 paid sick days, and once again, the reasoning behind trying to give this benefit to small business employees is there was a concern that larger businesses may already have similar benefits, and they wanted to make sure that nobody, because they were a small business employee, was forced to come to work or forced not to or take care of their loved ones during the coronavirus outbreak because they didn't have sick days. Okay. The way the two laws tie together is, I hate to say that Congress is elegant in anything they do, but this is kind of elegant. They provide the family medical leave, you recall, is 12 weeks. The first 2 weeks is unpaid. The next 10 weeks is paid at 2/3 of the compensation. Well, here they provide for 10 paid days under the Employee Paid Sick Leave Act, And that ties in to the 12-week period so that, in effect, somebody actually gets paid for the full 12 weeks, 10 days of which under this Sick Leave Act, and the other 10 weeks under the FMLA expansion. One thing that I want to make sure everybody has done is under the Sick Leave Act, you know, if you have somebody who provides you with, you know, the posters you post about minimum wage and employment laws and things like that, they should have also sent you a poster relating to the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. That has to be posted. And if your employees are working from home, then it wouldn't be a bad idea to email it out to them and just make sure that they're aware of their rights. And if you do this, it's relatively harmless. If you provide the notice, it's relatively harmless. And, you know, since we're all trying to do the right thing, it's just an easy step to take to comply with the law. Okay. So I've talked to people who were pretty worked up over this benefit that has been put on us, put on small businesses. And when I refer to small businesses as us, it's because I'm managing partner of a small business, and I feel the impacts of all these incremental employee rules. I think that a lot of the consternation about these particular benefits on business owners is militated by the fact that they are trying to make sure that ultimately small business doesn't have to pay the freight on this. And the way they've decided to do that is they are providing a Social Security credit that is a refundable tax credit against your Social Security contributions that you make. And so the way it works is, you know, if you have $10,000 of emergency sick leave that you've paid out, the next time you submit your Social Security reporting, you can claim that as a credit against your Social Security payment, and that's going to, in effect, pay down the cost of the employee benefits. Now, let's say hypothetically you've paid out $10,000 and you only owe $5,000 on the Social Security payments to the government. You still get the full benefit. What happens is you submit the $10,000, $5,000 gets your Social Security payment gets zeroed out, and then they'll cut you a check for the other five. Now the problem is from a small business perspective, there's a timing delay because you're paying out the money with every paycheck, and you only true up the Social Security reporting every 90 days. So you are out for a period of time, but ultimately you will get this money back. And this was the funding mechanism that they decided to pay for this. And it's not as good as an immediate payment or having the government pay the employees direct, but it isn't bad, and it will work. And ultimately, within 90 days, you'll be caught up on the money. Now, this is one of the things that we need to be very careful about is the tax credits only cover employees who are subject to the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Expansion Act or the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. It doesn't cover situations where either you're voluntarily making payments to employees who may not qualify for that act but can't come to your office, or, you know, for whatever reason they're part-time and you're paying them and they're not subject to the act. You know, it is only for the FMLA type payments or the emergency FMLA expansion payments or the emergency family or emergency paid sick leave act. And I apologize for stumbling over the names of these. It is not the most user-friendly of naming mechanisms. So anyway, there's no voluntary opting into the laws to obtain the tax credits. They need to qualify, and to the extent they do, they absolutely get credit from your Social Security. That is really a very, very quick overview of the employment law aspects that were added to small businesses. It's it is something that you need to do for the employees. It's something that to the extent that you can do this and keep a compassionate, caring image with your employees, that's nothing but a positive. And it's something that will help you once you get past this crisis. Okay, the more clearly positive benefit of the third act, which is the CARES Act, is the focus on small business loans. And there are really two loan programs, and they both have their benefits. There's one is the emergency injury disaster loan, which is the typical SBA loan for emergencies. I don't want to minimize the importance of this act. It is this loan program. It's a good solid program. If you're impacted by an emergency, an economic emergency, you're allowed to submit a loan application to the SBA directly. And what you do is you fill out a fairly detailed application, detailing your business, your credit worthiness, and your and the available collateral that you have, and you submit it directly to the SBA, who performs the underwriting. Now, last week I went onto the SBA website to try to see what that would be like, and candidly, the system kept crashing. And you expect that because everybody was trying to get on and see what they would qualify for and what the program would look like. Now, I've had a client yesterday fill out the application, and it went very smoothly. These loans are, they're subject to, the terms are up to 30 years. It's a 3.75% interest rate. They are secured loans, and that was the big problem for when I was looking at it was we've already granted a first lien in all our assets, so we'd have to go out and get a subordination in a form acceptable to the SBA, and that would be difficult for some unique reasons. And for loans over $200,000, excuse me, there is a guarantee requirement, which some people don't mind signing guarantees, some people do, and that's something that you would have to evaluate with your owners and see what their appetite is for that. That and like I said, this is a good program, and if you qualified for it, if you qualified for it, it wouldn't be a bad thing to get. But the third stimulus act added a new loan program, which is really, I was talking to somebody yesterday, and they commented that they had been talking to a venture capitalist who said you'd be foolish not to look into this, and I wholeheartedly agree. And that is the loan on the loan program on the next slide, which is the PPP loan program. And this is a $350 billion loan pool and it's PPP stands for Paycheck Protection Program. And this is something that if you don't listen to anything else I say during this presentation, listen to this. You would be foolish And I just saw a note that the EIDL application has been improved, and that's really good, because I went through it last week and it was painful, and I know that they are trying to make the program easier. But the PPP program is kind of a unique beast that everybody needs to at least evaluate in terms of how their business works. It is designed to assist you specifically to cover the expenses of maintaining your employee base, and it's administered by local banks. Now, the applications they aren't with my bank yet, but they promised to have them by mid to late this week. And I saw a quote from the Secretary of Treasury. Secretary of Treasury that they intended to get the money flowing at the end of this week, which probably means the beginning of next week, but still it's something they're moving very quickly on. Because this runs through your local bank, it's essential to stay in touch with your local banker. Indeed, I've been just an absolute pest with my banker on this, because I don't want to miss by one day the first day I can apply to this. I did see an article from Forbes yesterday, and in it I wanted to was a quote that I want to share with you, because it really is true how important the banks are to this program. And what the article says, said, at any rate, how I, your accountant, your really smart cousin, or your barber read the act doesn't matter. Even if we are right and the bank is wrong, it will be what the bank says. And that's something that you just really need to keep in mind, that the bank is ultimately going to be the final arbiter of how this is set up. But essentially, the way the program is designed to work is, if you have fewer than 500 employees, you can go to your local bank and you can get a loan. And you know, it's a very wordy formula, but it boils down to essentially this, that if you can get a loan equal to an amount of 250% of the average monthly payroll expenses for your company. And so if you had a payroll of $20,000, just pick a number out of the air, of qualified employees, then what you would do is you'd get a loan of $50,000. And you can use that loan for the next 60 days for payroll costs with adjustments. They don't want you putting it all into your highest income employees, but you know, you can pay for payroll costs, you can pay your rent, you can pay mortgage interest, you can pay group health insurance premiums during a 60-day period. And to the extent you do that, and also you maintain your employee base and your payroll through that 60-day period, the loan's forgiven. And you have no repayment obligations. And what makes that even better is the loan is the loan does not constitute forgiveness of debt income to you. So it's not a matter of, oh, the bank forgave debt and all of a sudden I have a tax bill. No, you're out from under it. Now, if you can't get the full amount forgiven, then the terms of the loan still aren't very, very onerous. It's a 10-year loan with a 4% interest rate. The loan is unsecured. There are no guarantees in the loan, and it's really it really is a benefit to everybody to really be at least in touch with your bank and see if they're offering the program. And if they're not, find a bank that is. Because this is money that the government has given you, essentially to keep your employees on the payroll for a 60-day period, and you know, when I read about this, I was really excited, because I've been, you know, in administering our firm, I've been trying to save every penny I can to keep our payroll or keep our employees on the payroll for as long as I can. And if they're going to give me enough cash to do that for 60 days and I don't have to tap my savings, I'm happy as can be. And that's something that you really need to consider. And if you don't look into this, it's managerial malpractice. I mean, you're really hurting yourself. And like I said, I contacted our banker probably 5 minutes after the House passed the bill on Friday. And I've been bugging her on a fairly consistent basis ever since, because I want to get this loan applied for and I want to get the money. Now, I did see a question come by, and it has to do with the interplay of the the first loan program, the EIDLs, and the PPP loans. And you cannot have both loans outstanding for the same purpose. The grant is the loan is something that you get a PPP loan or you get an EIDL loan. Now, there is one aspect of the EIDL loan that I didn't mention, and that is that three business days after you apply for the EIDL loan, you can get a grant of $10,000 for to cover you in the short term. Now, that $10,000 grant is offset against the PPP loan if you go and get that. But it is a valid strategy to use to go and apply for the EIPL loan, get the grant, and then get the PPP loan and not pursue the EIDL loan. It's something to think about. It's something that I would encourage everybody, please get with your banker, get with your accountant, get with your lawyers, and try to determine what's the best strategy for you. But the one thing I will repeat is, if you don't do anything, if you don't take advantage of these programs, or at least see if you qualify for these programs, you're really shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, this is the one clear benefit for small business that came out of all the stimulus. And I would hate for anybody who is eligible not to take advantage of it because they don't know about it or because they haven't contacted their banker. Now, I think we're at the end of my slide presentation. I did want to make a couple of points that didn't really lend itself to the slides all that well. And that is, where are we going from here? You know, they're already talking about stimulus 4. I saw today that the House Democrats were drafting their version of stimulus 4, and I saw the president about 45 minutes ago tweeted. He tweeted a wish for a $2 trillion stimulus for infrastructure. Now there's a long way between a tweet, a rumor about drafting, and actually law coming in place. But I guess my word of caution to you is two or threefold. First of all, I don't really see a ton of an incremental stimulus coming to small businesses in the near term. So if you're waiting to take advantage of the programs that are out there because you think something better may be on the way, I think that's a misplaced hope. Secondly, I think anybody in the collection industry who does not keep their eyes on state regulators at this time is foolish. You know, in the last week, we've had pronouncements of varying severity and clarity from Massachusetts, North Carolina, and Illinois about how they're going to be treating collectors under their stay-at-home laws, whether or not there's some sort of stay on collections or in the case of North Carolina, a mandatory disclosure that you make to people when they call in, telling them that you'll delay the payments for 30 days. You know, that's out there. And I think that it would be it would be foolish to think that that's the those are the last states that are going to do something like that. Now, I think the feds are going to be pretty silent in the next 30 days because both houses of Congress are in adjournment until the 20th. And indeed, I read one article today saying that the Senate was trying to extend that out into May. And if they're both not in town, they're not going to do anything. I want to caution one thing. A lot of people have gone to a work-from-home model in the last 20, 30 days. And I don't think anybody in the industry loved the concept of work-from-home from a compliance perspective. But I do think that, necessity is the mother of invention, and you had to do something. And I would make the same decision as those people that have gone to work from home. Pay particular attention to the Illinois pronouncement if you went there, because Illinois, in their licensing statute, requires you to disclose the work locations or the locations of the licensees, and they are taking the position that those individual homes are locations of the Illinois or of an Illinois licensee. So just be aware of that. Study that. Get with your lawyer on that. Last thing I want to say before I turn it back over to Mike is everyone be safe out there. We're going to get through this. We're going to get through this. I think that, one of the things that we're struggling with as a society is we have so much data that's negative, and we've got scientists who are very intelligent telling us how worse things are going to get, which is probably true. I don't doubt that for a minute. But I want to remind people that as leaders of our organizations and the companies that we own and that we run, the very best leader I ever saw in a business always showed a positive face to the organization. And it didn't matter how bad things were on the balance sheet. They always showed a positive face because they were convinced that there was something called the shadow of a leader, that your employees are looking at you, and it doesn't matter, really what they say, what you say. What matters is the way you carry yourself and whether or not that you present a positive, optimistic view of life. And that's really hard in these days. And there have been days when I've left my office thinking that, am I going to open the doors tomorrow? But it doesn't help for me to let my employees know that I'm thinking that. And so I would urge everybody in this very difficult time to keep their eye on the end game, which is going to have businesses reopened. And things are going to get better ultimately, and we need to get there. With that, I want to turn it back over to Mike. I see that there are a couple of questions, and I want to answer one or two of them. And then I am going to suggest that we consult with our own counsel or drop me an email and I can chat more directly.
Okay.
The first question has to do with whether or not the an employee can collect the labor benefits that we outlined, even though the company is still open. And the answer really is, the answer is yes. And let me give you the hypothetical which proves it. Let's say you've got an employee who's the caregiver for a child, and the child is in school, and the governor has shut down all the schools in that particular state. And, that would be almost a definition of when you can take your emergency family medical leave, even though you technically may still be open. It's one of those situations. As I said earlier, I would urge people to err on the side of giving the benefit when they could, if the person qualifies, simply because being too tough on these benefits, while it has a short-term economic impact, will play poorly with the employee base, and will also play poorly with people in the community at large that you're going to be trying to hire in July and August when you have all this debt to collect. So be smart, be compassionate, I guess is my answer. And the answer to the question is yes, there is a way that the employee can collect even if you're open. There is some question about whether or not the qualified SBA loan has forgiven debts or forgiven payments. The answer is the payments are deferred. And under the EIDL program, it's a 12-month deferral. And then you start making payments. So you get past the past the crisis. Also, excuse me, the PPP program, you know, the entire loan is capable of being deferred or being forgiven. And to the extent there's any money that is outstanding on a PPP loan that is not deferred, to the extent there is money on a PPP loan that is not written off because you've maintained your employee base, that those payments are deferred for a period from 6 to 12 months, subject to whatever particular criteria your bank comes up with. There are a bunch of other really good questions out there, and I apologize. Both my voice and our time is coming to an end. So if you could shoot me an email, and if you don't have my email, reach out to Mike and my email is tgood@bn-lawyers.com, and I'd be glad to communicate with you through that or any way you want. But for the benefit of the group and also for the benefit of my voice, I'm going to turn it back over to Mike and let him put a wrap on this.
Well, excellent, Tom. Thank you so much. And I will happily forward any requests, any questions, anything that you anybody emails me. I'll happily send it to Tom if you didn't catch his email address, and make sure that that he responds and gets that message to that you have. So, Tom, thank you so much. This is incredibly dynamic, incredibly fluid, incredibly new, and you know to sort of sit through this and for me to be able to understand it. Believe me, that's saying a lot, because a lot of this has been going over my head. So thank you for taking the time to share this information with us. It's an incredibly important time for the industry, and these are incredibly important things that the industry needs to know about. So thank you very much. Thanks again to ACA of Texas for partnering, and thanks to Tom Morgan for ACA of Texas for coming to me with this idea. This was his idea. I apologize. We've had some technical difficulties and we couldn't get Tom on the line. But I want to thank him for coming to me with this idea. And I was really excited to partner with ACA of Texas to put on this webinar, and look forward to doing this with them and other associations in the future. So thanks to everybody who participated. Please stay tuned to AccountsRecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. I hope everyone continues to stay safe, and hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day. Tom, thank you. Great job.
Thanks a lot.